with the philosophy of rebirth. So I think I'm showing page 759 on my book. I'm not sure what the pages on the other books are, so if somebody else has a different copy. I think last we read was the paragraph starting with the universal spirit in things. Is that what everybody else also has?
Yeah, it's the same number for me. This is just me down.
Is the chapter called Rebirth in Other Worlds?
No, the chapter is called The
No,
Philosophy of Rebirth. The Philosophy of Rebirth, it's about 4 pages from the end.
so yes, I think you're right. It's
Mm-hmm.
that paragraph beginning, the universal spirit in things involved in the sense of the physical universe.
It is page number 792 in the other book.
Okay, so that's 759 and 792.
Paragraph ends, 791 paragraph begins.
So do we want to start by rereading that paragraph, Debashisha? Or do you want to say a few words before that, or?
Were you planning to reread the previous paragraph or that paragraph? Had we already read that paragraph, the universal spirit in things?
No, I think we stopped with the previous one.
Okay. Maybe we can very briefly review what Sri Aurobindo is trying to do in this chapter, since we've had a little break and we've come almost to the end of the chapter. In this chapter called The Philosophy of Rebirth, Sri Aurobindo is not concerned so much with giving us the process of rebirth, which he does elsewhere, and which is connected with the whole issue of karma, for example. But he's interested in probing the meaning and significance of rebirth. And he approaches it from a point of view of asking the question first, is there such a thing? And if there is such a thing as rebirth, what is its meaning and significance? So that is really what the drift of this chapter is. And what it's involved with are a few aspects of existence. Firstly, the fact of what he has elsewhere called the temporal ignorance, the fact that we as human individuals find ourselves as conscious beings, nature body, a body which is made up of mind, life, and physicality, appearing and disappearing in this phenomenal universe. And so, this succession of appearances and disappearances, and I use the word succession not from the viewpoint of rebirth, but from the viewpoint of phenomenal existence, things appearing and disappearing constantly in front of us. Is there any permanence to these appearances and disappearances? This becomes the first question. Is there anything in the individual that will outlast its physical body, vital body, mental body, its nature sheaths? That is the first question. And the intuition of an immortality which we carry with us, something which outlasts temporality. Then there is the phenomenal observation of evolution. And normally we are faced with a materialist description of the evolution of forms. This is what Darwinian evolution has brought to our notice. And in a a way, it has obscured the other aspect of evolution, which is the evolution of consciousness. Not only do we observe an evolution of forms in this universe, but we also observe an evolution of consciousness in the universe. So, what is the relationship between these two? And what is the relationship of these with these appearances and disappearances of individual existence on the earth? So these are the major questions that Sri Aurobindo raises in this chapter, and he relates them to what he has already introduced about the involution and evolution of spirit. And one may say, this chapter actually brings to a focus the theistic basis of Sri Aurobindo's philosophy. Theistic in the sense that behind the whole explanation of the philosophy of rebirth is the idea of God as a person, the personhood of God, the person who has multiplied himself, one and infinite, whose infinity is his self-multiplication, is in innumerable forms and beings. But each one of these forms and beings carrying within it the evolutionary possibility of manifesting the fullness of this one person. So why, we may ask, would it be necessary for that one person to be self-manifested in an evolutionary form through successions of lives until innumerable such unique representations or self-representations can manifest? Well, the answer is Leela. And here the answer of Leela has to do with the notion of the manifestation of the divine in a play, the one self-multiplied at play with himself in innumerable forms, but also as innumerable consciousnesses. So this evolution of consciousness and the evolution of forms goes hand in hand in the universal evolution, leading to an eventual fulfillment of the self manifestation of a play of God in and with itself in innumerable forms. So this becomes the drift of the philosophy of rebirth. And this is in a sense where we are right now. The philosophy of rebirth presupposes that this one person has involved himself in the principle of his opposite, in an inconscience or a nescience, which is impersonal and unconscious, and from which personality emerges in innumerable possibilities gradually. And it is this phased and graded emergence that ultimately leads to all these manifold manifestations of forms and consciousnesses. Now, the play between form and consciousness is what causes the evolution of the self-discovery and the self-mastery of the one in its innumerable portions. Consciousness emerging within the inconscience through automatic processes of nature gradually begins to take hold of its instruments. And to do this, it is faced with a challenge that repeats itself for innumerable lives through vast periods or spans of time, and particularly in that two paragraphs before where we are, Sri Aurobindo brings out so beautifully in his profound manner the nature of time in the evolutionary process. So the necessity of this repetition of consciousness trying to become self-possessed of its instruments through a succession of births, through becoming more and more master, is what gives significance to rebirth. And in this process, there is a double evolution taking place. One is a universal evolution, and the other is an individual evolution. Were it not for the theistic basis, the fact of the personhood of God, there would only be a universal evolution. But because God is a person, a being, who is manifesting himself for his own delight of play in innumerable persons as his own names and beings, that we have the individual evolution. Each individual is a self-representation of that one person. So that person is a multiple person, as Sri Aurobindo says, a multiple concentration of the one. And this infinite multiplicity of the one person is the infinite individualities that are evolving along with the universality of nature. And the relationship between this transcendental being, the universe with its universal evolution, and the innumerable individual evolutions within the universe is what is so very interesting and profound in Sri Aurobindo's work and in this chapter. Because ultimately, the relationship can be reduced to identity. The three are one. It is the one transcendental person that has become this universe. It is this universal being that is self-multiplied in every individual. And therefore, every individual, each one of us, is an evolution of the individual, of the universal being, both in itself and as its portions. This is very important to understand, that this apparent paradox of being a separate individual in a containing universe and being the universe itself. Each one of us is the entire universe, identified with the universe, and yet a portion of the universe. And again, each one of us is beyond the universe, the one being who has self-multiplied itself into all these beings, and has self-represented itself as a form in the universe. It is important to understand this because the transcendence of the universe is also part of the individual evolution. To know oneself as an individual, as a portion, a part of the universal being, to know oneself as identified with the entire universal being, and to know oneself as free of the universal being, master of the universal being, beyond it, are the three goals of individual evolution. And the three goals, you may say, of universal evolution. Because these are one. And in both these, it is the involution of the transcendent being and the transcendent person that is working out its fulfillment of the Leela, the play of the one, with his many portions. think at this point, I would recommend going back two paragraphs and reading from that particular paragraph, which begins, birth then is a necessity of the manifestation of the Purusha. And if there are any questions or comments, we can take them at this point and then move on.
Yeah, I have one question, Debashisda.
Yes.
I remember reading a letter or a writing of the mother, but just to paraphrase, I'm not sure how accurately I remember it. Essentially, it goes on to say how there was a plunge into the abyss, and from there a cry arose, and then the divine dived in to save the creation. Or, I mean, I'm not saying it exactly right because I don't remember, but perhaps you do. So how do we contrast that with the concept of Leela, which makes it much more of a conscious choice rather than a plunge and a cry from the abyss?
No, when we talk about a plunge and a cry from the abyss, and again the divine entering into that particular description that you mentioned from the mother is actually a very ancient and a profound description, which is also present in the Veda. And this is given in the nature of two creations. These are two different creations. The first creation is the creation of a universal inconscience, and the second creation is the creation of the possibility of individuality through the sacrifice of the Purusha. One you may call the sacrifice of the Prakriti, and the second one you may call the sacrifice of the Purusha. The sacrifice of the Purusha is the dismemberment of consciousness. That is why you may say that when the cry goes up, the cry is a universal cry. The cry of the universal inconscience. But what responds to that are the innumerable or infinite portions of fragments of divine consciousness, the one transcendental person becoming the potentiality of infinite persons. That makes the possibility of the individual evolution as the beginning, the initiation of the journey towards the Leela. So this is only a process. You know, to talk about the process as something which will result in a Leela is only to talk about a phenomenon. But the process of the phenomenon, it doesn't necessarily have to be either a self-conscious choice, which it is from above, or a cry from the abyss, which it is from below. Both these are truths and realities and processes by which the same phenomenon can be described. So, whether we call it a leap in terms of process, it...
We seem to have lost you for the last 10 seconds or so.
Lost me meaning what? Lost my voice or lost my content?
No, the voice. Is it only me or did others also?
Yeah, I think we lost. We couldn't hear for a few seconds.
Yeah, I can hear him now, but yeah. We lost him in the middle of talking. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we lost him again.
Description, pardon? Oh, I was just saying that this. Hello.
Yeah, now we can hear you.
Yeah, I was saying that this description is just a process. This process can be seen from above or from below. If you see it from above, then it is a choice of the Supreme. The whole thing is a choice of the Supreme. But if you see it from below, it is the Supreme that has entered into its own inconscience and is seeing it in a different way as the anguished call for self-remembrance out of its own amnesia, and as the entry of the possibility of many consciousnesses into that amnesia. So, however we look at it, this is a process, but the phenomenon is the phenomenon of the evolution towards the Leela.
Thank you, Devashishta.
Well, Devashish?
Yes, Vince.
My question is simple, but again, what is the difference between Leela and Maya?
Well, here I'm using the term Leela as the play of the divine person in a self-multiplied form. So the reason I'm using it is that the true explanation of rebirth, the philosophy of rebirth, cannot be complete, as Sri Aurobindo has brought it out, were it not for the personhood of God becoming active in each possibility of individual evolution. Each one of us is not merely a principle, not merely a conglomeration of forces, not merely a self which can lose its nature, but a composite of self and nature, a person. This personhood ultimately takes its root in the divine person. So, why should the divine person multiply itself in so many of its possibilities? Is it just to know itself in innumerable ways? Yes, that is one answer. But this self-knowledge, what one might call this innumerable or multiple self-knowledge, can also become dynamic as a play of delight. This dynamic play of delight of innumerable perspectives on the Infinite One is also known as Leela. So that is what makes the whole idea of the multiplied person a reality behind the philosophy of rebirth. Now, Maya is something else. Maya is the self-conceptive power of the divine. So being, supreme being, can conceive of itself in whatever form it wants. It can use its power of self-conception to represent itself, to become the universe, to create whatever form of itself it wishes. That power is Maya. So Leela is actually a kind of a play of delight of the one person in many personified forms. While Maya is the power by which that one in this universe.
Well, thank you for that. I'm still not quite sure I grasp the difference, but that's for another time and place. But thank you.
Thank you.
Do I also remember some kind of myth of creation about a dismemberment of a person?
Yeah, that is the Purusha Sukta in the Veda. That is the dismemberment of Purusha. And that, in a sense, is similar to the idea of the plunge of the divine person, of the supreme person, in the mother's telling, into the unconscious. That is the sacrifice of the Purusha, yes.
So, shall we start reading?
Yeah, let's.
Meera, do you want to start?
Yeah, I can start. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Birth Birth then is a necessity of the manifestation of the Purusha on the physical plane. Birth is birth, whether the human or any other, cannot be in this world order an isolated accident or a sudden excursion of a soul into physicality without any preparing past to it or any fulfilling hereafter. In a world of involution and evolution, not of physical form only, but of conscious being through life and mind to spirit, such an isolated assumption of life in the human body could not be the rule of the individual soul's existence. It would be a quite meaningless and inconsequential arrangement, a freak for which the nature and system of things here have no place, a contrary violence which would break the rhythm of the spirit's self-manifestation. The intrusion of such a rule of individual soul life into an evolutionary spiritual progression would make it an effect without cause and a cause without effect. It would be a fragmentary present without a past or a future. The life of the individual must have the same rhythm of significance, the same law of progression as the cosmic life. Its place in that rhythm cannot be a stray, purposeless intervention. It must be an abiding instrumentation of the cosmic purpose. Neither in such an order can we explain an isolated advent, a one birth of the soul in the human body, which would be its first and last experience of the kind, by a previous existence in other worlds, with a future before it in yet other fields of experience. For here, life upon earth, life in the physical universe is not and cannot be a casual purge for the wanderings of the soul from world to world. It is a great and slow development needing, as we now know, incalculable spaces of time for its evolution. Human life is itself only a term in a graded series, through which the secret spirit in the universe develops gradually his purpose and works it out finally through the enlarging and ascending individual soul consciousness in the body. This ascent can only take place by rebirth within the ascending order. An individual visit, coming across it and progressing on some other line elsewhere, could not fit into the system of this evolutionary existence.
So, if we pause for a moment just to catch the salient features of this paragraph before proceeding, the very first line introduces that notion of the divine person who is entering into time is as forms of individualized evolution. That's why that line, birth then is a necessity of the manifestation of the Purusha on the physical plane. So that is first. And then the question of rebirth. If birth is the necessity of the manifestation, is this a freak birth? Is it a birth that takes place without any preceding history or any successive history to it? Or is it possibly coming from some other planet or other evolutionary universe into this world as a journey, a travel, a wandering, a casual perch, and moving on to some other universe? Or is it intimately related to the universal evolution of forms and consciousnesses on Earth itself? This is the next most important question relating to rebirth, once we have answered the question regarding birth. And there, that line is so beautiful because it gives us a perspective on significance? What is the meaning of time as far as consciousness is concerned? For here, life upon earth, no, not that line, it's the next one. life upon earth is what he's talking about, but the sentence moves on and says, it is a great and slow development, needing, as we now know, incalculable spaces of time for its evolution. Human life is itself only a term in a graded series through which the secret spirit in the universe develops gradually his purpose and works it out finally through the enlarging and ascending individual soul consciousness in the body. And these sentences really invite us to contemplate the nature of time in the universe. You know, the human consciousness feels at one level as if it is constrained by the hurrying stream of physical life. We are caught in a succession of moments that is so minuscule, so momentary, so conditioned by events that are constantly dragging us from moment to moment and day to day. But at the same time, the human consciousness has a contact with, and in fact an identity with, a spirit of time which is very vast, which is enormous, and which actually gives us the truth of our own psychic existence. The soul is not something that appears and disappears in single lifetimes, but is something which is intimate to the history of the earth. And Sri Aurobindo is inviting us to contemplate for a moment what that means in these sentences. This aeonic endeavor of consciousness, of which we are intimate participants, not just in this lifetime, but have always been. This is what he's drawing to our attention over here. And based on that, he is drawing this, you know, significance of rebirth, the significance of rebirth that is tied to the universal evolution that is taking place here in this terrestrial world. The terrestrial world, we think about this earth, but material universe may be a broader way of putting it. Now, another question arises from that though, a question that may be uncomfortable. And that question is, that then where is our freedom? Are we bound? Are we like, you know, these sort of, like these genies who bind spirits to a certain work in time? Are we thus bound to the aeonic endeavor of the earth? The Greek philosophers, from a very early mythical time, have looked at the human life in this form, that there is a tragic sensibility to the bondage of the human soul. We are stuck here. We can't get out of this, though we move from life to life. And the answer to that is, in our universal form, in our connection with the evolution of the earth, we are bound because we have chosen to be bound. We have chosen to be bound because we are an aspect of the divine will that has chosen this particular manifestation. And this choice is a free choice, not just free in its initiation, but always free. Even in its bondage, it is absolutely free. That is the form of its freedom, chosen in the evolution. So it is only when one understands the form of the human journey, of the human soul, as a form of self-chosen freedom, that we can get the drift of this aeonic, you know, sort of, I mean, relationship with the evolution of consciousness. Maybe we can move to the next paragraph where he will draw that out even further.
Then this is, I have a question regarding the, I was trying to understand the pronouncement of Krishna to Arjuna saying that I had many lives and I know, in essence, all of them and you don't. Does it really mean that what can you explain on that statement of Krishna? How is that?
You see, in a sense, yes. In fact, that is a very, very powerful line in the Gita where Sri Krishna is almost defining his avatarhood in terms of that aspect. He's saying the only difference between you, Arjuna, and me is the fact that I know all my births while you don't. Now, one would wonder what exactly he means by this. And does he just mean this knowledge of the succession of births in time? Answer is yes, but it goes beyond that. It goes beyond that, and it is truly understandable only in the light of the Vishwarup Darshan. The knowledge of all the births of the divine person, see again, here it is, the answer to that question goes to the first line of that paragraph. Birth then is the necessity of the manifestation of the Purusha on the physical plane. This is Purushottama himself. All the births that are taking place here, every single line of evolution is a birth of Krishna or a birth of the transcendental person. When he says, I know all my births, it is not merely the births of the avatar that he's talking about, but he's talking about every possible birth and rebirth that is taking place here. He's saying, I have the integral knowledge of time. And you, Arjuna, don't have it. What Arjuna can have is that integral knowledge, but he can only have it in phases. He can first have it as a succession of his own lives through contact with the psychic being. He can then have it as a knowledge of his own independence of this succession of lives through contact with the Paramatman, the Supreme Being aspect. But he can also have it in the way in which Krishna has it, as a knowledge of the Supreme Person who is becoming self-multiplied in every birth, but he cannot have that without the grace of Purushottama. That is what he gets in the Vishwarup Darshan. So in a way, this knowledge of all his births that Krishna is talking about is the ultimate knowledge of the Purusha who is manifesting himself in this world, all these evolutionary possibilities happening here.
I have a question. Does the avatar know that there are two planes, right? Deterministic and probabilistic.
Yes.
So that deterministic plane, does the avatar, when he is, I mean, of course, because he is avatar, of course, he is on Earth. So while on Earth, is he in contact with that deterministic, or does he have the hold on that deterministic plane?
Yeah, this is actually a very profound question. And the answer to the question actually may not be something that is common to all avatars at all times. The idea seems to be, from what Sri Aurobindo and the mother seem to be saying about it, that deterministic knowledge, ultimately the deterministic plane that you're talking about is the supramental plane, the highest levels of the supermind, where the idea, the real idea, is constantly or always in possession of itself. Now, notion of time is where the real idea is being manifested. So, in its experience in the manifestation, it is not aware of this deterministic plane. It is in a probabilistic plane, as you say. So, the paradox of the avatar is the coexistence of the deterministic and the probabilistic planes. They coexist, and it is unthinkable for us, but in a way, that is the reality of the supermind, that coexistence at the same time of these two planes.
So, if they really coexist, that means that they're just acting, knowing what is going to happen, but it's just like knowing the drama and then performing on the stage, correct?
In a way, yes, but each has its own reality. Because, for example, when Shyam asked that question about the Leela and the holocaust of the Purusha, there again it's the similar kind of thing. That is, the Supreme Being knows that this is what is going on down, in the inconscience, but the experience of the inconscience, of its pain, its aspiration, its cry for the divine transcendence to enter it, is a reality all the same. So that is at the probabilistic plane where nothing is known, and in the ignorance there is a journey towards knowledge. So that putting of the veil on itself is also a reality, and that reality is experienced as a reality, while at the same time some other part of the being experiences the freedom from that reality. So, you know, in a sense, even when Sri Aurobindo talks about the triple transformation, this is what he means. He means that there is the possibility of an existence in which one aspect of our existence is completely free and in the possession of the knowledge, but another aspect of our existence is completely working out from moment to moment the unknowable.
Yeah, fascinating that Sri Aurobindo, knowing what is ought to happen, yet sometimes hopes and sometimes doesn't hope as much. Actually, not Sri Aurobindo, the mother herself. Sometimes she hopes and sometimes she is not sure whether human species is going to go all the way. So that's actually root cause of my question.
Yeah, very true. In fact, Sri Aurobindo too, which is what in fact Kiritji's passage from the Life Divine was bringing out. In that very passage, she's also doing the same thing, hoping but also knowing, as it were, while at the same time one could say that he knows. So that deterministic plane, and the veil of determinism on the relative plane are simultaneously present, and depending on where the consciousness is stationed, one is active or the other is active. In fact, there are places where the mother says, or even Sri Aurobindo says, that, you know, there are points of time when the consciousness rises into the supermind and all is known. But when it descends here, a deliberate veil is put on some of that knowledge. So even the act of that deliberate veil is part of the action of the avatar in its
You are cutting off. We cannot hear you.
I was saying that, you see, there are places where Sri Aurobindo and the mother both talk about rising to a supramental status where everything is known. But when they come back to the earth consciousness, there is a deliberate veil that is put on their knowledge so that some of it is not known. actually, it is even mentioned in terms of the fact that if it were known, that would cause a disbalance in the universe itself. Because any knowledge that is known even by one person has a certain effect, immediate effect. So Avatar can negotiate between these two planes by choosing to put veil on certain aspects of the determinism.
I mean, in Sri Krishna, Arjuna, that I know my birds, that is also on earth plane, right?
Yes.
So if that is possible, I mean, that means that even in ignorance, of course, Arjuna is in the plane of ignorance. Even in that plane, he is saying that that's the difference between not just going at certain other time and then coming back at certain other time. It's at the time when he is on earth, at that time he will know all his births, right?
Yes. Yes, he is saying that. He is saying that.
So
he is saying
then,
that. Yeah, now that actually there are two possibilities there. One is that, that's why I started my answer by saying that this question is also something that is dependent on the nature of the specific avatar. So perhaps Krishna was manifesting some aspect of divinity that defies this particular rule. That he is self-manifested as Purushottam. And yet it may be that what he's saying is that it is accessible to me. May not be that this is my reality at all times, but that this knowledge of all my births is accessible to me. By choice, I can have it, in other words.
He also mentions that is the difference, that is the only difference between an avatar and a human being.
Right. That is, I have put the veil on myself, and he also gives the process of avatarhood by saying that you have come by the process of nature. I have come by my own action on nature. I have forced nature to bring me out in this form. So it's like saying, I have put the veil on myself and I can remove the veil whenever I want it. While you are conditioned by the veil in the process of nature.
Thank you.
Devishishta?
Yes.
I wanted to know about this concept of determinism, which you just talked about. It was very interesting. It seems like a divine determinism here, through the real idea, you're in full possession of the truth. But the way we experience determinism in our daily life is through a kind of a mechanistic determinism of Prakriti, the movements of Prakriti. So, I mean, what would you have to say about that in the evolutionary process?
Yes, that mechanistic determinism of Prakriti is our bondage. It is the bondage of consciousness. And in the evolution, we must be free from it. But this other determinism that was being talked about is the view from the plane of the real idea, of the supermind, where there is meaning to the universe, and we have chosen that meaning. So freedom from the you know, automatisms of nature is the first necessity for the soul. So the soul has to be free of that determinism. Once it is free of that determinism, it can actually master the instruments of nature. But once it does that, it becomes aware of a universal determinism. That universal determinism ultimately takes its root in the overmind and beyond it in the supermind. Because the universe has been, you know, sort of created as a representation interpretation of the real ID. Now, but it is a free determinism. That's why when we talk about, I talked about this in this particular paragraph, that it seems as if we have been intimately associated with the evolution of the earth. Can we say that our soul then is bound? Is it imprisoned by the evolutionary movement? The answer is, it is a free choice. And then when we talk about the determinism of the real idea, we are talking about the free choice of the real idea. In other words, transcendence is not bound by any particular idea. It has chosen to manifest a certain idea by its own self-delight. So once it chooses that, there is a determinism to it because there is an idea involved. But it is free of that. It can change that, or it can create other ideas or manifest itself through other ideas. This is actually the reason why there is the need for the third transformation, the supramental transformation. Otherwise, we would know ourselves to be the entire, identified with the entire universal movement, but still be bound by the determinism of that movement.
Thank you. Very interesting.
Oh, Devashish?
Yes, please.
What were you saying about planes of probability?
Yeah, the deterministic and the probabilistic plane, that is what Keka was talking about. And by that is meant the fact that here, if we look at our earthly existence from a certain point of view, nothing is certain. Everything is a probability.
Correct.
We don't know what will happen next. Our phenomenal existence in terms of our power of knowledge is a probabilistic one, while the description of the universal movement in terms of the view of overmind or supermind is a deterministic one, because there the real idea and its ramifications are seen. So it seems to be a necessity that drives the movements of time, while here it seems to be a play of forces that drives the movements of time. That is the difference between the deterministic and the probabilistic claim.
That's very interesting. Where is it in Sri Aurobindo that he mentions that, the probabilistic and the deterministic?
Well, I know where Keka got it from, and she can tell you where she got it from. She got it from the mother's conversations.
Okay.
Can you tell Vince where you got it from, Keka?
Sorry. Yeah, actually, the links that I sent about that, those three questions, those have those discussions. It's page 28 to 31, maybe, of Mother's Conversation.
Do you know what year?
It's actually the Mother's Conversation 1929 to 1931. That is one book that has been separately published. You can also get it in Mother's Questions and Answers. In that particular part between 1929 to 31, whatever conversation she had with the disciples.
Okay, and that would be in the collected works?
Could be, I'm not exactly sure. Yeah, but it's definitely in Mother's Questions and Answers.
Thank you very much.
No problem.
Yeah, it would be in collected works. And it would also be in a separate book called Conversations, a small book called Conversations, okay, which is what she's talking about. Shall we move to the next paragraph? Because this paragraph is so beautiful. And the next one is a shorter one, but very, very powerful, and brings to a kind of a crystalline kind of what he has introduced.
Monica, do you want to go? Anybody else? Rosemary?
Nor is the human soul, the human individual, is it that one?
Yeah.
A free wanderer, capriciously or lightly hastening from field to field, according to its unfettered choice, or according to its free and spontaneously variable action and result of action. That is a radiant thought of pure spiritual liberty, which may have its truth in plans beyond, or in an eventual release, but is not true at first of the earth life, of life in the universe, in the physical universe. The human birth in this world is on its spiritual side a complex of two elements, a spiritual person and the soul of personality. The former is man's eternal being, the latter is his cosmic and eternal being. As the spiritual impersonal person, he is one in his nature and being with the freedom of Satchidananda, who has here consented to or willed his involution in the nescience for a certain round of soul experience, impossible otherwise, and presides secretly over its evolution. As the similar personality, he is himself part of that long development of the soul experience in the forms of nature. His own evolution must follow the laws and the lines of the universal evolution. As spirit, he is one with the transcendence which is immanent in the world and comprehensive of it. As a soul, he is at once one with and part of the universality of Satchidananda, self-expressed in the world. His self-expression must go through the stages of the cosmic expression. His soul experience follow the revolutions of the wheel of Brahman in the universe.
So, this beautiful little paragraph we had studied last time, I remember, and Sri Aurobindo raises that question of freedom, which we just talked about, and actually says that that notion of freedom, absolute freedom of the soul, it's ability to move from universe to universe, a condition of consciousness to condition of consciousness, is a truth of being, a thought of pure spiritual liberty, but a truth in some other planes of existence, or maybe in an eventual release, as he says. Because freedom of the transcendent being allows it to manifest in whatever way it wants. It is not bound to this universal movement. But one of its forms of manifestation is this evolution in time. And the very notion of time is something which is paradoxical, because the eternal manifesting in time creates a kind of view of itself as quantum, as quantifiable, as duration, as progression. And this quantifiability of eternity in terms of progressing experience is a poise of the freedom of transcendent being, a poise of Satchidananda, which is its immanence in a manifesting universe. So immediately, we are talking about our own experience as individuals as being in essence a double experience, two poises of consciousness. One poise outside the manifestation, and one poise which is immutable, and one poise which is, as he says, part of the cosmos and identifiable with the cosmos. The cosmos itself in a certain form and a portion of the cosmos. That is the psychic entity. We discussed this a little bit last time. The psychic entity as the individualization of this Jivatman, which is in itself a self-concentration of Purushottama, Paramatman, or actually ultimately Purushottama, has become both these in each of us. And this multiple self-concentration at the level where it remains outside of time is the entire universe of infinite possibilities of Jivatmans. And again, the self-multiplication projected into a progressional manifestation is the various evolutionary possibilities of these Jivatmans as the psychic entities moving from birth to birth, evolving more and more powers of consciousness and formations of consciousness, becoming more and more in control of its habitations of nature, finally expressing a soul personality as the psychic being, and then taking full control over its nature sheaths, instrumentality, then finally recognizing or realizing itself not merely as a portion of the universal movement, but a representation identical with the universal movement, its cosmic reality, and then even beyond that, recognizing itself to be none other than the absolute freedom of the transcendent Purushottama in an individual form. So this journey of the psychic entity coexists with its simultaneous status as the free Jivatman, always in possession of its entire trajectory. The Jivatman carries, as it were, the image of the entire movement in time, eternal movement in time. That is where, again, that paradox of eternity and time fulfillment in, again, the paradox of determinism and probability find their fulfillment in the duality of Jivatman and psychic entity.
Shall we read the next paragraph?
Sure.
Vince, do you want to read?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, sure. The universal spirit in things involved in the nescience of the physical universe evolves its nature self in a succession of physical forms, up the graded series of matter, life, mind, and spirit. It emerges first as a secret soul in material forms, quite subject on the surface to the nescience. It develops as a soul, still secret, but about to emerge in vital forms that stand on the borders between nations in the partial light of consciousness, which is our ignorance. It develops still farther as the initially conscient soul in the animal mind, and finally, as the more outwardly conscious but not yet fully conscient soul in man. The consciousness is there throughout in our occult parts of being. The development is in the manifesting nature. This evolutionary development has a universal as well as an individual aspect. The universal develops the grades of its being in the ordered variation of the universality of itself in the series of its evolved forms of being. The individual soul follows the line of this cosmic series and manifests what is prepared in the universality of the spirit. The universal man, the cosmic Purusha in humanity, is developing in the human race the power that has grown into humanity from below it and shall yet grow to supermind in spirit and become the Godhead in man who is aware of his true and integral self and the divine universality of his nature. The individual must have followed this line of development. He must have presided over a soul experience in the lower forms of life before he took up the human evolution. As the One was capable of assuming in its universality these lower forms of the plant and animal, so must the individual, now human, have been capable of assuming them in his previous stages of existence. He now appears as a human soul, the spirit accepting the inner and outer form of humanity. But he is not limited by this form any more than he was limited by the plant or animal forms previously assumed by him. He can pass on from it to a greater self-expression in a higher scale of nature.
I believe, as you were reading it, that I think maybe we read this paragraph also last time, which is what yielded the discussion regarding the Vishwa Manava and the universal Manu and the tapas of Manu, which we were discussing the last time we had this.
Yeah, we did read this. Once we read it again, it's coming back.
Yeah. But in essence, it is talking about that interdependence of the universal movement and the individual movement. Individual movement is not in isolation of the universal movement. In fact, it is identical with it. It is an aspect of it, an emanation of it. And it is not dependent on any particular form. And at the same time, the point that is being made is the intimate relationship of soul and nature. The fact that whatever nature body is taken up is related to the evolution of the soul, because it is a form of the soul's self-representation and manifestation in nature. So the soul is not dependent on any nature form and can mold greater than in nature. But at the same time, neither is any particular nature form arbitrary. These nature forms are not given to the soul out of some kind of whim of a dualistic reality where nature acts separate from the reality of soul. But the two are part of an integral reality in which nature forms have to do exactly with what the soul needs for its self-manifestation and evolution at any time.
I have a question. Is it possible to give an example of this manifestation of the universal Purusha? To my experience, as I understand the universal consciousness, as to whatever extent I understand, is that the Prakriti, which is mechanical and blind, doing its yoga, and the Paraprakriti, which answers to individual, to the call of the individual aspiration, each individual aspiration. And as a result, the evolution is taking place. So this, where this universal Purusha, universal individual, in other words, like universal being, which is aspiring, that is not subject to the, which independently exists other than the individuals, the sum of individuals.
Yeah. Susha?
No.
Of any particular species. So, universal Purusha is aspect of Purushottama in that particular species. You were talking about para prakriti. So, para reality of anything, whether reality of a species, reality of a plane, is always composed of union of Purusha and Prakriti. So, it is Purushottama and Paraprakriti that form in their conjunction the reality of any particular plane of existence or any particular being. But when we use the term person, then we are actually talking about that union, that conjunction. Person cannot be thought of without some kind of integral soul-nature combination. It always has a nature, it's not only a self, but it also has a nature. So we can look at it as Paraprakriti or we can look at it as Cosmic Purusha. In either case, it is the combination of the two that is involved in any particular universal manifestation. So universal human being, for example, which is not the agglomeration or conglomeration of all the individual human beings, but that being which is self-manifested as all the human beings, it's self-multiplied as all the human beings. It will be so self-multiplied in forms and through a process of concentration that belongs to Paraprakriti. But its essence is as Purusha, is as Vishwamanav or as Vishwapurusha. So that Purusha as a emanation or a form of Purushottama is what gives ultimate freedom to any particular aspect of whether individual or universal reality. Universal reality, Purushottama as a Purusha in the universal reality is going to remain in a certain poise of concentration which is given to it by Paraprakriti. So that is why it is, in a sense, inert. And we know it only through the action of Paraprakriti. That is its tapas. Until the individual, in its evolution, can surpass it, can identify himself with it and surpass it.
Devashish?
Yeah.
How does that connect to, individually, the psychic entity becomes the psychic being when it crosses into the human? Is that like the universal aspect of that? I don't know.
No.
Okay.
No, that is the individualized aspect of that. It is, right. In fact, the full individualization of this individual aspect of the evolving emanation, the universal Purusha. Universal Purusha, you may think of, when we are talking about universal Purusha, we are talking in terms of occult reality of each species. So, human being, for example, has universal human Purusha. That is what Sri Aurobindo is calling Manu in some places.
Okay.
So, this Manu is just a poise of Purushottama. A poise of Purushottama at the human level. Mm-hmm. So, this Manu has got all the characteristics of the human. In other words, what will be the possibilities of being?
Okay.
In other words, what will be the possibilities of experience? That, you know, irrespective of instruments, human being will be capable of.
Okay.
That constraint will be that of the defining reality of universal being at the human level. So that then will be self-multiplied through an act of concentration. This self-multiplication will yield innumerable jivatmans that are human jivatmans, you see. And at the same time, each one of these will be self-projected into time as an evolutionary movement of a psychic entity.
Okay,
that psychic entity will then further develop a soul personality in conjunction with its nature bodies and become the psychic being.
So it's like being becoming.
Yeah, yes. Being becoming, yes.
Oh, thank you.
So, can it be said that universal being actually exists in the experience of the individual as the universal, universal aspect of the Purushottama?
Individual can attain to identity with that universal aspect of the Purushottama, because individual is also a self-representation of that universal aspect of Purushottama. The universal aspect is prior to it. In other words, it is an intermediate poise of Purushottama that stands at the head of a particular species.
Yeah, exactly. So basically, it is a poise, the being, poise of the aspirant, poise of the principle. Like, it is not, we cannot figure it like we can for the individual. That's what I'm asking.
Figure it in what sense? Means, does it have an independent reality? Is that the question you're asking?
Yeah, exactly. Independent aspirant, meaning, like, for example, an individual.
It is not an aspirant.
Huh?
It is not an aspirant.
Yeah.
It is not an aspirant.
Right.
Aspirant, you can only talk about at the level of human individual. Or individualized aspect of aspiration or of psychic reality. This one does not have that. There you are quite right. What it has is a poise, only a poise of being. Now that poise of being can be identified with by the aspiring individual, and it can also be overpassed by the aspiring individual. Can you hear me? Hello? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hello,
I
don't.
I can hear you, Devashishi.
Yeah, I can. Okay. I can hear you. I think you faded for a few seconds.
Yeah, now I can hear you.
I see. Did you hear my answer?
Yes, yes, we all can
yes.
hear you.
Yes,
no.
Yes.
Okay.
Debashista, is the Vishwamanav
yeah.
a being of harmony, unlike the, like, for example, lot of human collectivity experiments have sort of failed so far because of lack of harmony, but this being, is he an ideal collective?
Well, you know, the answer to that really again depends on what is the poise of this Vishwamanav, you know. Because again, these beings, when we are talking about beings as a poise of being, poise of supreme being, they have projections on many levels. So Vishwamanav can exist in overmind, Vishwamanav can exist in the vital, Vishwamanav can exist in supermind also. So essentially it is like a universal being of the human, a universal human being. If that identity can be experienced by identification or union with Vishwamanav by a collective, for example, then that kind of identity at the supramental plane will be an experience of harmony. Harmony can also exist at the overmind plane. It is only not the full identity and freedom. Creative freedom is not there. It will be on a certain level. It can be there.
So I think you already explained once before the comparison between Vishwarupa and Vishwamanav. Can you explain that again?
Well, Vishwarupa is transcendental being, supramental form. And that is actually, in a sense, not a poise of the human Purusha. Vishwamanav is like the universal human Purusha. Even at the transcendental plane, it is bound by the experience of the human. But transcendental being in its Vishwarupa, the term Vishwarupa is being used, if you look at the description, it is really a supramental, you know, description of the transcendental being of Purushottama. So it far exceeds any scope of Vishwamanav. It takes in all the manifestation that is prior to the human and all the manifestation that is beyond the human. It captures past, present and future, and it also captures form and formlessness. And it goes beyond, and yet it has the unmistakable sense of being a person. See, that is why it is Purushottama. It is the supreme person beyond all forms of person, including all forms of person that can ever be and that have ever been in the past, that can ever be in the future. And at the same time, it is not bound by any of these. That is the freedom of the total freedom of the divine person, the mystery of the divine person. That is Vishwarupa.
Shall we read the next paragraph?
Okay, we can read the next paragraph, and I would suggest we stop after that, since some of us will have to wake up pretty early tomorrow for Kiriti's address. So why don't we read the next paragraph and then call it halt for today?
Jyoti, did you want to read?
I would love to, but I haven't got a clue where you are. I just joined in late, and so maybe somebody else can. I haven't even got a clue in front of me.
Keka? Anybody else wants to?
Yeah.
Shall I?
I'm Anjali.
Ah, sure.
Yeah, Anjali, can you read?
Go ahead, Manik. Okay. To suppose otherwise would be to suppose that the spirit which now presides over the human soul experience was originally formed by a human mentality and the human body, exists by that, and cannot exist apart from it, cannot ever go below or above it. In fact, it would then be reasonable to suppose that it is not immortal, but has come into existence by the appearance of the human mind and body in the evolution, and would disappear by their disappearance. But body and mind are not the creators of the spirit. The spirit is the creator of the mind and body. It develops these principles out of its being. It is not developed into being out of them. It is not a compound of their elements or a resultant of their meeting. If it appears to evolve out of mind and body, that is because it gradually manifests itself in them and not because it is created by them or exists by them. As it manifests, they are revealed as subordinate terms of its being and are to be finally taken up out of their present imperfection and transformed into visible forms and instruments of the spirit. Our conception of the spirit is of something which is not constituted by name and form, but assumes various forms of body and mind according to the various manifestations of its soul being. This it does here by a successive evolution. It evolves successive forms and successive strata of consciousness, for it is not bound always to assume one form and no other, or to possess one kind of mentality, which is its sole possible subjective manifestation. The soul is not bound by the formula of mental humanity. It did not begin with that and will not end with it. It had a pre-human past. It has a superhuman future.
Now, in a way, this paragraph also has something to do with that discussion we were having about Vishwamanav. And I would also draw attention to the previous paragraph and also this discussion about Vishwarup and Vishwamanav. So when we look at the previous paragraph, you see, let me summarize by saying that in this universal evolution, the Supreme Being is marshalling various strata of consciousness and form. And in an occult sense, each one of these strata has behind it a poise of the Supreme Being that extends the kind or the possibility of experience that strata will have. Now, when we come to the human consciousness, the human existence, there is a certain occult being that presides over this particular plane. Now, there is a problem here though. The problem is, the human being is not a type of being. The human consciousness, the human individual is not destined to stop at the plane of human species. At the same time, there is a certain kind of type of being associated with the human being. That is what we are calling Vishwamanav. So Vishwamanav, what is Vishwamanav? How can we typify Vishwamanav? Now in this particular paragraph that was just read, towards the end, you see that description which is given of our conception of the spirit. It says, our conception of the spirit is of something which is not constituted by name and form, but assumes various forms of body and mind according to the various manifestations of its soul being. This it does by a successive evolution. It evolves successive forms and successive strata of consciousness, for it is not bound always to assume one form and no other, or to possess one kind of mentality which is its sole possible subjective manifestation. See the next line, the soul is not bound by the formula of mental humanity. It did not begin with that and will not end with it. It had a pre-human past, it has a superhuman future. Now, this formula of mental humanity that he is talking about is the possibility of experience carried in the poise of being. That is the typal man. Again, in the previous paragraph where he talks about the universal man, you see how he describes it. The universal man, the cosmic Purusha in humanity, is developing in the human race the power that has grown into humanity from below it and shall yet grow to supermind and spirit and become the Godhead in man who is aware of his true and integral self and the divine universality of his nature. The individual must have followed this line of development. He must have presided over a soul experience in the lower forms of life before he of the human evolution. Now here we get the key that there is a typal being which is a poise of the supreme being at each strata of evolution. So to the human level, this typal being is the formula of a mental humanity. That is the possibility of experience that is carried as the typal stage of humanity. Now, human being, however, is not a typal being. It is an evolving being that, as he's saying in our conception of the spirit, is beyond name and form. It is not constrained by mental humanity. Therefore, it is passing into the stage of mental humanity from an evolution in pre-human lives, and it is going to pass out of the stage of mental humanity into an evolution in post-human lives. According to many philosophers today, not only Sri Aurobindo, who actually gives us the integral picture, many other philosophers who are called today postmodern philosophers, believe that we have come to the end of the human cycle, that we have entered into what is called a post-human phase. And this post-human phase is indeed the point of time in which human individuals begin feeling the attraction of an aspiration that takes them beyond the Vishwamanav. It is the human, the mental humanity that has reached the end of its tapas. And it is a higher tapas that attracts the aspiration of the human psyche at this point.
Shall we stop with a short meditation?